You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people, the places, and oh yeah, the potties of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. If nature calls while commuting on a bus or a train in LA County, finding a public bathroom can be, well, good luck.
I've never even seen a bathroom in the subway, so...
That's M. Tillman. She's one of several hundred thousand people who ride Metro every single day. And despite all those passengers, many of whom have commutes over an hour, the agency operates just three public restrooms across its entire system. Three. But now relief is on the way for at least some Metro riders caught doing the, you know, the dance. Metro has recently doubled the number of available restrooms. Yeah, there are still only six. But the new ones are no-touch, high-tech, portable bathrooms. There's only one catch. If you want to use them, you need a cell phone. Reporter Jackson Cantrell has the story.
When you're out and about and need to go, it's often a race to the nearest restaurant or store. And most of those are for customers only. You'll have to either grovel for a bathroom code or fork over $3 for a coffee. All right, by coffee, I mean a venti half-calf double-shot iced caramel macchiato pumpkin spice, and by $3, I mean $8.95. If you do find a public restroom, you may want to hold your nose when you use it. So I was surprised to find that at the Westlake MacArthur Park Metro Station, the cleanest, nicest-smelling spot there was the bathroom.
Please limit your use to 10 minutes. Wave at the light on the door to exit when you're done.
Meet Throne, the portable restroom with a robot voice. Scan a QR code with your phone, send a text, and the door opens. It's roomy. There's a sink, toilet, urinal, baby changing station, and a fan that turns on when you walk in. The vibe is boutique hotel meets mobile medical clinic. Jungle-themed plant wallpaper, a vanity mirror with LED lights, plus a red Sharps disposal box mounted on the wall. One thing missing, handles or buttons of any kind.
The great thing about it is this. You don't have to touch anything.
That's Jermaine, a Metro rider who just visited a Throne restroom for the first time.
All you have to do is wave your hand, and the toilet flushes on its own. When you wave your hand, the door opens for you to exit.
The high-tech toilets are part of a pilot project between Metro and Maryland-based Throne Labs. It started in October and runs through March. Stephen Tu leads the station experience team at Metro. He says the pilot couldn't have come at a better time. The permanent restrooms are a huge pain in the butt.
Constantly, we are dealing with large items or clothing, items that are not, I guess, septic safe or plumbing safe. That causes massive amounts of damage and maintenance issues for us that cost the agency money.
He says, besides the plumbing issues, there's vandalism, drug use, and inappropriate behavior.
As a result, we typically have to staff those locations with security guards, which is costly, and it prevents us from being able to have effective security in other parts of the station because we're essentially monitoring that single unit.
I pointed out to Tu that the Throne pilot has raked in a ton of criticism online. People say the cell phone requirement excludes riders who need the bathrooms the most. He says tying bathroom use and misuse to a phone number is about accountability.
And then what happens is the subsequent user after is able to rate the cleanliness of that restroom. If there are habitual users, in theory, who are misusing the restrooms, who are vandalizing the restrooms and ruining it for everyone else, they can be warned and they can potentially have their privileges revoked.
And people without phones? Tu says Metro staff and other riders tend to help out. And cell phone access is more widespread than people might think. 92% of riders have them. I brought up another common complaint to Jess Heinzelman, Throne's co-founder and chief operating officer. The 10-minute limit. Some say it's not enough time. Heinzelman calls it a safety measure.
Because in a traditional bathroom, you're in there, you've locked the door, and if you have a heart attack or an overdose, you stay in there until somebody with a key comes along.
If they work well, Metro could extend the program. But are these things cost-effective? Let's compare it with the public restroom Metro runs at El Monte Station. Metro estimates bathroom security and maintenance there cost over $21,000 a month. The throne toilets typically run 1/4 to 1/3 of that cost. Heinzelman says pricing will likely stay at that level, but it could go up a little depending on any unforeseen challenges during the pilot. And it's pretty much been challenge-free since the launch. The throne restrooms have seen 2,500 uses without a major incident. Heinzelman isn't surprised.
When you give a really nice resource to people that aren't used to being given nice things, the majority of them will treat it very well.
As I was leaving MacArthur Park Station, I saw a man with dreadlocks and a baggy striped shirt reading the throne instructions.
Are you trying to use the restroom?
Yeah.
Do you have a phone?
No, unfortunately, I get stolen off my shirt.
Your phone got stolen?
Yeah.
Do you want me to open the restroom for you?
That'd be great.
Yeah. I think I got a...
I'm having a phone today.
Gabriel Fury lives in and out of homeless shelters in Koreatown. I unlocked the restroom for him with my phone, and we caught up 5 minutes later.
How is the cleanliness in there?
Oh, God, immaculate.
How does that compare with other restrooms you use?
Made me feel a whole lot better where I can actually stay in there and breathe, you know, without holding my breath. I was able to use the restroom, wash my hands, look in the mirror, and it only took me like 3-4 minutes.
For Fury, finding a restroom is a daily struggle.
I usually have to, like, look around for, like, 30 minutes.
And what do you think about the needing the phone to get in there?
Well, that's not a big deal. I mean, I think everybody has a cell phone nowadays.
Besides MacArthur Park, the new throne toilets are at the Willowbrook Rosa Park Station where the A and C lines meet, and at the Norwalk C Line Station. So if you're passing through, go ahead and get the Big Gulp or Thai iced tea before you hop on the train. For KCRW, I'm Jackson Cantrell.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The fire is mostly out after a huge hangar burned in Tustin, but the air around it is still a danger in Orange County. Officials have declared local states of emergency after the behemoth blaze at a blimp hangar at the former Tustin Marine Corps Air Station. Smoke and debris from the fires tested positive for asbestos, lead, arsenic, and nickel, and that's leading to school and park closures and health warnings nearby. Here with me to talk about it, GLA's weekly regular LA Times columnist, Gustavo Arellano. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
How long is, these hangars are huge. How long have they been around, and what's the history of that one that burned?
There's two blimp hangars. There's the one that burned down, and then there's another one that still remains. They're twins, and they were built during World War II, and they literally held blimps. And those blimps, they were supposed to go up and down the Pacific Coast in California to guard against the Japanese invasion. And then after World War II, they kind of just stood there. It was still a Marine Corps station, even though it was built by the Navy at the time during World War II. They became iconic in the Orange County landscape. I mean, going down the 55 freeway, and you see these humongous, humongous structures. And if you don't know the history, you just think, like, what on earth could they be? And even as developments went around the blimp hangars, they still became a beloved part of almost the Orange County imagination.
Were they being used for anything?
So the military base there, the Marine Corps Air Station, it officially shut down in 1999. So the Marines used it. They would store helicopters in there. They would store different things in there. After that, of course, though, no, they were just empty. I mean, they were used for Hollywood shoots, but very few people were ever let in because, again, they were still maintained by the Navy. It was still the military. It was still military grounds. And you would always wonder, like, what's in there? And more importantly, what, if anything, are going to be done with them?
the fire, and it was, I mean, a spectacular blaze. When I say spectacular, I mean you could see it for miles and miles because it really lit up the sky. It started last Tuesday, then it died down, and apparently it erupted again over the weekend. Why has this thing been so hard for firefighters to put out?
It flared up again on Saturday. It flared up again yesterday night on Sunday because these structures are so massive, 17 stories high. At first, firefighters, they were trying to fight it with helicopters, like if it was a wildfire. And then the Orange County Fire Authority, they're like, no, we're not going to risk our firefighters to try to stop this. Like, the building's going to collapse, and we're just going to wait for it to collapse. So when you have a fire of this magnitude with a building like that, made out of wood, remember, it's made out of wood, so this is going to burn for a while, and there's no time estimate on when it's safe enough for them to start doing the demolition. This particular blimp hangar, I think the LA Times, we did the estimate that it was big enough to hold a football field, a soccer field, and a baseball field at the same time. You could play a game with them. This is a humongous, humongous structure that's burning down.
So let's get to the contaminants then that we're talking about, because if it's still smoldering, we still have smoke, and the air around this giant hangar has apparently asbestos and arsenic and lead and nickel. These are pretty old school contaminants. Asbestos is the one I think a lot of folks are most worried about. What's the environmental impact for something like that?
Oh my God, this is the scary part. So, okay, everyone loves the blimp hangars. They're so beautiful. We should do something with them. Oh, it's really sad that one of them's burning down. Oh, wait, you mean it's poisonous? Threads of asbestos were falling down onto the front yards and backyards of houses in Tustin. And Tustin Unified, they shut down their schools. Today, Monday, it's only going to be a day for staff, so students are not going to go in there. Irvine schools, because this, where the blimp hangars are, it's near Irvine. It's also near Costa Mesa and Newport Beach, for that matter. So Irvine schools are still open, but the South Coast Air Quality Management District, they're monitoring assiduously because these are contaminants that are horrible. I mean, asbestos, nickel, my gosh, even nickel. Like, you know, I don't live too far away in Santana, and I woke up this morning and I could smell something. It wasn't the smell of the Santa Ana winds. It was something else in the air. And then it's supposed to rain later this week. So who knows what's going to be the environmental impact of just this one building, just one big, huge building burning.
All right. So schools closed, some parks, like areas around. What are local residents being told? I mean, people who live nearby, like you and other folks in South County, what are they being told to do?
Stay indoors. If you go outdoors, wear a mask. Be careful. Watch out for updates. And that's the thing. We don't know how long it's going to go. Hopefully, with the rains, that'll cool down the embers that are within that one hangar, and it's not going to burn anymore. But then once, I mean, imagine again, like, yes, it's burned down a lot. Now you have to demo the rest of it. You don't think, and it's asbestos, this is something that's going to take months to tear down. In fact, the reason why both of those hangars were just left alone was because the Navy and the city of Tustin, which owns the land around it, they had no idea what to do with them. They were like the ultimate, what do you want to call it, white elephant gift, albatross across your neck, beach whale, use the animal metaphor that you want. That's the Tustin blimp hangar that just burned down. But none of those metaphors are toxic. This is toxic.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, our regular, of course, here at GLA. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Just ahead, if you're a worker at a theme park, costumed hostess or host, hospitality worker, you might have a lot to talk about. Good thing there's a way to do that, and you'll hear about it next. Moving on now with Greater LA from KCRW, I'm Steve Chitakis. Let's head now to the happiest place on Earth, where magic is still alive and you can meet some of your screen idols, Mickey and Pocahontas and Snow White.
He would come up to me and he would try to kiss me on the mouth. And he would tell me every time he saw me, he's like, I know you're the real one because your eyes are brown. So he'd always get kind of uncomfortably close. I was alone. I was 16. And this creepy old man keeps coming up and like is not quite all there.
Oof. All right, well, maybe the magic gets a little too real for some folks. And yes, those character actors, or cast members, as Disney calls them, have a lot of stories. A new podcast called Keys to the Kingdom lets them tell those stories. It's hosted by Amanda Lund and Matt Gourley, a couple who met while working over at Universal Studios, also as character actors. And they're here now to tell us more about the hard realities of working in the land of make-believe. Amanda, Matt, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Hi, Steve.
I mean, Snow White is... obviously, it's a fun character, right? I mean, you've got the, you know, it's animated and lots of color and everything. And then you've got some creepy old guy who's not going away easily, right? I mean, so these are some of the stories that you hear.
Yeah, it's a new twist on the old hag. Instead, it's just an old man in the park, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Amanda, that stuff really happens, right?
Yeah. Now, I was a Disney princess for a handful of years, starting when I was 17 years old. And I didn't play Snow White. I played Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and Ariel. But the majority of the park guests are well-behaved, possibly dirty little kids, but not dirty in that way. Dirty as in covered in churro cinnamon.
Oh.
But every once in a while, you do encounter, you know, someone who is going to act inappropriately, and you have to kind of know how to navigate that in a graceful princess-like way.
Well, navigating is one thing, but talking about it, right, and mentioning exactly what happened to you and sort of letting it out there is another, and that's the whole basis of your podcast, right?
Yeah, Matt and I have a shared theme park history of, I think, you know, over 15 years. We've both worked at Universal, at Disney, and we just had so many stories and had so many friends who had so many just incredible stories. And so we just were so excited to, you know, do a podcast where we could kind of just give people a peek behind the curtain of what it's like to work at these theme parks. And some of the people we called in, you know, really were kind of nervous to talk to us, and hence why we use code names in certain situations and disguise some voices, because, you know, people are nervous about sort of breaking that magical wall.
Sometimes that creepiness is actually coming from within the house, meaning some employees there themselves can even be a little, I don't know, having partaken too much of the Kool-Aid, I guess, of the Disney idea. And you sometimes feel like you're walking through a cartoon yourself, and people have glazed over looks in their eyes. Not everyone, like Amanda says, it's the majority of everyone is wonderful and nice to work with, but you can't help but run into some questionable people, either as guests or coworkers.
An episode of the podcast is dedicated to fan interactions and interactions that turn weird. Princesses are even trained to deal with the fans that get a little too handsy. Let's hear.
But Deep Skirt, do you remember the technique we were taught in princess training when people got handsy?
Yes, you put their arm up and you grab their arm and hold it like, or their shoulder, so it keeps their hand from being on you.
So you say, let me pose you like a prince, which is code for get your dirty hands off me. Your children are right here.
I mean, Amanda, is that really true? That happens? Like you've got to maneuver something, like get that, ooh.
Oh, yeah, like dads or whoever, like, you know, bros on a fun guys trip to Disney will come up and lean in and smile and kind of manhandle you, like grab you around the waist like they're posing with, you know, someone they know really well. And Cinderella's a married woman. She can't be photographed posing like that with another man. So you just really pleasantly say, oh, well, let me show you how to pose like a prince. And you make it sort of a fun little cute thing you're doing for the picture. Now, it does also work for kids who are like sticky with chocolate ice cream or bodily fluids, you know?
Oh, no. Oh, so and does it go too far?
All theme park employees are kind of like having to know how to navigate interacting with all different types of people, people who are stressed, people who just spend a lot of money to get there and they feel they're entitled to your autograph and your picture because this is their one time in their life they're going to be there. A lot of people say park guests check their brains at the gate. And I found that to be true, unfortunately.
And it's also sort of a release for the folks, the character actors. They have to be on all the time. And Matt, I wonder if you know, someone gets tired of keeping that happy face on the job. Do people just crack?
Yeah, Amanda and I have talked about this recently because you're a human being and you're having good days and bad days. And I remember going through a really hard time struggling through a breakup and having to go do an improv comedy show. And I would be like very sad and then just have to click that off and put on a kind of, you know, plastic smile and go out there and do comedy and make people's lives a little happier and, you know, for lack of a better term, more magical.
And what about, you know, so you're out there at Disneyland or Universal in your case, and you're wearing some fuzzy outfit that's like, I dressed up as Mr. Peanut years ago when I was an intern on the radio and I had to walk in a parade and I was waving. By the way, the Peanut outfit was 100 pounds. It was so heavy, and it straps on your shoulder, and it was so hot in that thing. Imagine being in the South in the middle of summer, and humidity's 130%, and you've got this giant costume on. I would imagine doing that all day, and I just walked in a parade, and I got sick of it. I wanted to, you know, burn it in a pile. But you guys, if you have to do that all day at the park...
Well, I never luckily had to do that, but we talked to some people on the show. For instance, an actor who played Harry from Harry and the Hendersons at Universal Studios.
A very fuzzy character. Very fuzzy.
So fuzzy. In fact, it's a costume made out of 100% yak fur and with a huge foam padding suit underneath in, you know, the San Fernando Valley in the height of summer. And he talks about how he would take his gloves off and just turn them upside down and sweat would just pour out of there like you were emptying a full glass. So there's definitely not enough pay that you could ever give these people what they're worth. It's insane.
And on your podcast, do they call in? Do they commiserate with you?
Oh, yeah. And they tell stories and tales out of school, especially those that are willing to, you know, go on record, but maybe have their voice disguised or use a code name. And there's all kinds of fun, happy, good, bad, dark, juicy stories where this really runs the whole gamut.
Knowing what you know now, would you still take your kids to Disneyland?
The most disturbing part about this is that we have taken our young 2-year-old to Disneyland. And I had a fairly cynical view of Disney after working there. But then seeing her eyes light up in meeting Mickey and Goofy, I started to see it through her eyes. And then I'm afraid I was like, oh, well, give me the Kool-Aid. Here I am. This is amazing.
And this is fascinating. So we interviewed a lot of people who worked in all sorts of capacity in entertainment at the theme parks. And across the board, everyone would tell all these horrifying, crazy, fascinating stories. And then at the end of the interview, they would go, but it's the best job I ever had. I'm so grateful for the experience. I made lifelong friends. I still love going to Disney. So it is just an extremely kind of complex, I think, like, experience that you have as a theme park performer, unlike anything else.
Amanda Lund and Matt Gourley, the hosts of Keys to the Kingdom, a podcast about the backstage experiences of theme park employees, many here in Greater LA, by the way. You've got Magic Mountain and Disneyland and Universal and Knott's Berry, all of them around the Southland. I want to thank you all for coming on, Amanda and Matt, and good luck to you.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks for having us.
That's going to do it for us this evening. I promise, no more Mr. Peanut stories about wearing that costume. Tomorrow, a book club in Venice reads aloud a James Joyce classic, one page at a time. It's only taken them 28 years. And how's that transition going over at LADWP to getting energy from renewable sources? The utility has a goal. Is it on track to make that goal? That's this week on Greater LA. Find us online at kcrw.com/GLA. How you doing? Do you have a story idea? Want to get the podcast so you can get the show on the go? It's all there at the website, kcrw.com/GLA, or you can get the podcast wherever you get the podcasts by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Michael Vogel, and Christian Bordall all helped run the episode this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Bye-bye.